So we're starting our series on sin, and we're going to be here for a while, just to warn you guys. We're going to be in this series for a while. And what we're going to be talking about is we're going to start out talking about what is the source of sin. Tonight we're going to be talking about what is sin. Next week we're going to be talking about what is the source of sin. Then we're going to talk about what the root of sin is. Then we're going to talk about what is the growth of sin. And then we're going to talk about the fruit of sin. Right, and those are the things that we're going to be talking about. And the fruit of sin are the things that most people are aware of. We're going to be going over a lot of the deadly sins. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of those. Gluttony, pride, envy, lust. We're going to be going over those very specific sins and talking about how they apply in our life. And the question that we got to ask before we begin this series is, why are we doing it to begin with? Why are we going over these things? Why are we talking about them? Because some Christians would come under the guise of saying, like, okay, well, why would we do an entire series about sin when we're saved from it? You know, Jesus, we're all saved. Why would we have to talk about specific sins? Why would we have to go over them? Other people would say, well, like the word sin is very archaic. It's very old-timey. I don't even like using it. Why would we do a study on this? This seems like very irrelevant for today. This is why we're doing it. When people, no matter who you are, Christian, atheist, whatever, when we look around the world, we notice that there is something seriously, seriously wrong with it. And depending on what your worldview is what your answer to what is wrong with the world going to be. And you're going to answer, what is wrong with the world? And then you want to answer, how do we fix what's wrong with the world? And this is why the topic of sin is so cool for the Christian. Because a lot of times when we share apologetics with people about why you believe that Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior, why he died on the cross and rose again 3 days later, we usually have to use kind of abstract apologetics of like, hey, let's go into history books and find out that Jesus really did die on the cross and rise again 3 days. Or we got to kind of use like abstract things of, you know, the apostles' testimony or different evidences through science. The reason why I like the topic of sin so much is because it is a relevant, up-to-date evidence for the existence of God and the gospel that every single person can see alive in their own life. It is probably the most powerful apologetic we have as Christians to prove the existence of God and the power of the gospel. And when people look at the world, when they say, what's wrong with the world? Right, spoiler alert, Christians say it's sin, and we'll talk about that. But when secular people look at the world, usually what we're looking at is we're looking at, why is there natural disasters? Why are there hurricanes like the ones that are hitting America right now? Why is there cancer? Why is there AIDS? Why is there death of any kind? Why is there murder? Why is there rape? Why do these things happen to us? It just doesn't seem right. If there's a loving and just God out there, why isn't he doing something about this? And the other way that we could look at things of what's wrong with the world is the way that people treat each other. You don't have to be a history major or a sociology expert to know that people can do some pretty horrendous things to one another. Again, this is not something that you got to go way back in history. If you just study, if you just turn on the news right now and look at what ISIS is doing to people right now, right, how can a group of people go into a village, murder innocent people, rape women, take their kids as captives? How could they do this? How could people oppress people like that? How can people like the Nazis put 6 million people in the concentration camps, stick them in showers and gas them to death? How can that happen? How can people like Pol Pot in Indochina gather up 1 million people, put them in fields and just mow them down mercilessly? How could that happen? How could somebody rape another person? How could somebody murder another person? How can people treat each other this way? It just kind of boggles the mind a little bit. And once again, it all comes down, the reason why we have to ask ourselves these questions is because what we're actually trying to do is we're trying to say, what is the problem and can we fix it? Is there a solution to these problems? Is there a viable solution to these problems that we can do something about? In secularism, there are solutions. I'm going to go over them and I'm going to kind of show why they're not viable solutions. So To the first problem, when you have natural disasters, what environmentalists will say, to both problems, by the way, is they'll say, well, this is just kind of the hand that we've been dealt. This is the way the universe is. You know, people die, people live. This is kind of the way it is. As Richard Dawkins, the very famous atheist, put it, he says, there is no good, there is no evil. We live in a universe that has nothing but pitiless indifference towards us. Right? That's his viewpoint of the universe. That it's just, this is the way it is. There's no sense in me crying about ISIS murdering or raping somebody. There's no sense in me weeping about a family member getting cancer and dying. There's no sense of that. It's just pitiless indifference. What's the point? But they have solutions. Some of the biggest solutions would be environmentalism and science. Right, so how do we fix the planet? Right? How do we stop global warming? Well, we drive hybrids and we, you know, eat a lot of veggies and we recycle and we take care of each other and, you know, we take our multivitamins in the morning and we eat healthy, and that's how you fix what's wrong with the world, you know, and slowly we can kind of reverse the effects of nature and death. Now, the obvious problem with that is that's a pretty big losing battle, isn't it? No matter how much humanity does to try to curb what nature is doing to us, nature still wins. Everybody's going to die. Everybody's going to suffer. And no matter how much science, no matter how much technology, no matter how many different programs we design, it's going to happen. You can't stop it. You could prolong the inevitable, but the inevitable will still happen. That's the issue with that one. The second way that we deal with why are people so evil to each other is sociologists will say, well, the reason why people do wicked things is because of unjust social structures. Right? I'm not ripping on this because it's one of my favorite movies of all time, but if you ever watch Batman Begins or any of the Dark Knight trilogy, that's kind of the point of that movie. You know, why are people evil in Gotham? And Batman's whole conclusion is like, oh, well, it's because there's poverty and there's unjustness in the city that's causing people to be evil. You see, people are actually good, but if you put people in a bad situation, then you create evil. You make them evil. You create criminals. And that was his viewpoint. And that's the viewpoint of many people in our society. Those of you guys who are in college or taking any classes, this is the message that's going to get rammed down your throats. The reason why the world is the way it is because we're just not treating each other right. And if we just run the parade of tolerance, understanding, welfare programs, equity, socialism, we can bring people into goodness. We can bring people into a better life. And here's the problems with that. Number one, it leads to a vast amount of arrogance. Let me explain. If I ask the question, if I look at the world and I say, how on earth could Hitler do what he did, or Pol Pot, or to give a really good example, this would be the easiest example I could give you guys, would be the Native Americans. When the Europeans came over to America and they looked at the way the Native Americans were acting, the brutality of their tribal warfare and the things that they did to their kids and the things that they did to conquered tribes and the slavery and the rape and all the things that were just rampant in their society, Europeans looked at that and they said, it must be something wrong with the Native Americans. And the second you do that, the second you say, the reason why evil things happen is because of people like that, you're immediately elevating yourself higher than that person. Does that make sense? And that is exactly how the Europeans justified the murder, the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people. You guys understand that? Because we all agree, as Europeans, we're like, yeah, murdering people and stuff is wrong, but these are not people. These are some savage group of individuals that the world would be better off if we just exterminated them. Even look at a modern day example, the Middle East, where we look at the Middle East as white Westerners and we're like, what's wrong with the Middle East? Oh, it's because they live in these archaic ways and, you know, they just don't have the technology and the prosperity that we have. So, you know how we're going to fix the Middle East? We're going to bring capitalism over to the Middle East, and we're going to bring democracy over to the Middle East, and it's going to fix them. Is it working? No, it's not working. It's not working. And that's my second point, is that this line of thinking leads to a deep amount of frustration. I think the best example of both coming together that you can just look up on the news today Look at what's going on with the hurricanes. Look at what's going on with Hurricane Irma right now, especially in the Caribbean islands. Look up articles on that. Where on one point, when you look up the articles on it, you'll see the absolute destruction and devastation that has been wrought from these things. And you'll have to look at it and be like, what is wrong with this world that something like that can happen? But then on the other hand, you know what you see? You know what people are doing in places like the Caribbean islands or Houston or Orlando or any of these other places that got hit by the hurricanes? Some people are rising up and they're helping each other out. But you know what a lot of people are doing? They're looting. They're stealing stuff. In fact, on the Caribbean islands, there's a very interesting article that I just read the other day where they're actually begging for Marines to come down and protect them. And they're, and you know, mothers and fathers, they're basically saying, like, dude, I don't feel safe to go outside anymore. I don't feel safe to do anything anymore. I need people 24 hours a day watching my property because looting is so rampant. And we look at that and we say again, like, what is going on there? And I could either blame, oh, it's the fact that, you know, people are poor there and that's what's going on. Or I could see that maybe there's something else that's wrong. There was a woman named Beatrice Webb. She was one of the architects of the modern British welfare system. Lived back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Her and her husband actually founded the London School of Economics. And she was a socialist and activist British leader. But she kept a journal. She kept a diary. And in 1925, she reviewed her diary from 1890. So, you know, about 30 years difference. And she read an excerpt from her diary where this is what she wrote. In 1890, she wrote, "I have staked everything on the essential goodness of human nature." Then 35 years later, when she read that, she wrote in the margins of her diary, she wrote this, "Now 35 years later, I realize how permanent are the evil impulses and instincts that are in us, and how little they seem to change, like greed for wealth and power, and how mere social machinery will never change that. We must ask better things from human nature, but will we ever get a response? No. No amount of science or knowledge has been of any avail, and unless we curb the bad impulse, how will we get better social institutions?" What's she saying? What's wrong with us? It's us. It's us. It's not some social institution. It's not the country. It's not the fact that you were raised in a bad home. The thing that's wrong with humanity is humanity. We're what's wrong with the planet. That's what she's saying. As a secular, as an atheist, she's seeing this. You see why I said that this is something that everybody can just see? It's not something that needs, you know, a degree in theology to understand that the world is fundamentally broken. Dan Ariely, who, when we get to the sin of deception and lies, we're going to talk a lot about this guy because he wrote a book on lying and it's really interesting stuff. But he did this fascinating experiment. I think it's hilarious. What they did is they set up a building and they invited people to come in and they had them do mathematical equations, right? They're like, hey, you got 20 minutes to do as many math equations as you can. And once you're done, for every question you get right, we're going to give you a dollar, something like that. We'll give you like a dollar. So after everyone finishes, they're like pencils down and they're like, hey, tally up how many you got right and go into the back and shred your papers and then come up and tell us verbally how many you got right. Now, what the people who were doing the experiment didn't know is that when they were shredding them, all the shredder did is it shredded the sides of the paper, but it left the middle intact. So now what do they get to do? They get to see who lied, right? They get to see who deceived a little bit, who said, yeah, I got four right when they really got two. And what they found is pretty much everybody who went in there lied. Pretty much everybody who went in there lied. He said some people lied a lot, but almost everybody lied a little. And they were trying to figure it out. Why do people lie only a little? Why don't they lie a lot? And this was the conclusion that they came to. They said, at the end of the day, people want to go home, look themselves in the mirror, and say, I am an honest, good person. That's what people want to be able to do. And if you lie just a little bit, you can justify that. But if you lie a lot, you're like, I'm a liar. So you can't justify that. And this is what he found. They've done the experiment in many, many, many different ways. And this is what he found. The only time where the numbers went up is when they gave people a better excuse to lie. So this is one of them. They said, okay, half the money that you get on these right answers will go directly to charity. And you know what they found? Lying went up. Why? Because people want to see themselves as good, honest people. And they're like, well, yeah, I lied, but I lied for what? Charity. I lied for a good cause. You know, some people are going to get fed tonight because I lied. You know, that's how people justify. And this is what he's discovering. This is what these experiments are discovering. There is something sick and twisted inside of all of us that wants desperately to have an excuse to do evil. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for an excuse to do it and to be able to look yourself in the mirror and still say, I am still a good person. That's how people who see themselves as good people can go and kill others. But they justify it because they're like, oh, I'm doing this for a good cause. Right? That's how the ISIS terrorists are able to do it. They look themselves in the mirror and they say, the people that I was killing were not people. They were rebels and hypocrites and atheists, and I'm killing them to make the world a better place. That's how even soldiers today can look themselves in the mirror after they've killed people and say, well, I'm not killing good people, I'm killing evil people and making the world a better place. See, there's something sick and twisted in all of us that just wants desperately to have an excuse for why we are the way that we are. And the stronger the excuse, the more rotten a person you can justify. You guys understand that? Now, this is what he said, and I think this is hilarious. He said, they've done it to about 10,000 people now, which is pretty ridiculous. And he says, now of the 10,000 people, he says, we've only had about a dozen big liars. And he said, these big liars have taken, maybe they've stolen like $100 or $200 from us. But he said, but of the 10,000 people that we've had do it, he says about 9,000 stole a little. So think about that. If 9,000 people just stole $1, how much do they lose? $9,000. But if only a dozen people steal a lot of money, that's still only a couple hundred. You guys see the point? So why is the world so rotten? Is it because of a tiny amount of really evil people? No. The reason why the world is so rotten is because everybody is a little bit evil. You guys get that? The tiny percentage of people who are super evil are not the reason why the world is like this. They add a little bit to the general pool. The little bit of evil that you justify every day is the reason why the world is the way it is, because everybody is a little bit like that. So what is this evil? What is wrong with us? Why do we have this in our lives? In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to the Romans entitled Romans. And in the letter, he goes through exhaustive lengths to prove that what is wrong with us, what is wrong with humanity, what is wrong with the world, is sin. That's his argument. That's his entire argument throughout the book. And he says, to ask the question, what is wrong with the world, is actually to ask the question, what is wrong with me? And people don't want to ask that question. People don't want to look at themselves. People would rather have an ethereal answer and say, what's wrong with the world is that, or those people over there, or global warming, or social structures, or this, or that. That's what people want to do. They want to blame. But nobody wants to think, what's wrong with the world is sin, and it lives in me. Nobody wants to say that. But that's unfortunate. Because Paul's argument is that if you don't say that, you cannot be saved. And we'll talk more about that later. But let me just really quickly deal with the idea of, we're not going to get into it tonight. I would like to get into it, but it's a topic in and of itself. We're not going to get into it. The idea of natural disaster. What does Paul say about natural disasters? Read it on your own time. In Romans 8, this is his argument. In Romans 8, Paul argues that what is broken in us, the sin in us, is so wicked, it's so evil, it's so detestable and rotten, that not only is it horrible, but it disguises itself. It disguises itself to such an extent that people don't believe that they're actually sinners. And so what he says in Romans 8 is that God has placed pain and suffering in this creation as a metaphor for what's rotting in your heart. Does that make sense to you guys? That there is something unbelievably wrong and disjointed in my heart. And God gave me a powerful metaphor, a bloody metaphor, for exactly what is wrong with me in the form of pain, death, and suffering. C.S. Lewis, who understood this argument, wrote in the book The Problem of Pain, "God whispers in our pleasures, He speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world." So God is trying to get the attention of humanity, and He uses drastic measures to try to get our attention. Now, what's wrong with saying the word sin? You remember what I said, that a lot of people don't like to use the word sin because it seems archaic and lame? I think there was an author who, a Christian author, obviously, just a couple years ago, he wrote an article called What Sin Really Is, and I think he nailed it. I'm going to read this little excerpt for you guys. He said, "Everybody knows that sin basically means indulgence or enjoyable naughtiness. If you were worried, if you were really worried about somebody, you'd use a different word or phrase. You'd talk about eating disorders or addictions. You'd go to another vocabulary cloud altogether." This is what he's saying. When I use the word sin, this is how we've lost as a culture the meaning or the definition of sin. When I say the word sin, people usually think what I'm talking about is something that's really fun, but God says no because He's a bummer. Right? Where I'm talking about, you know, having sex before marriage, and people are like, yeah, really fun, but God just says no. I mean, think about, you know, commercials and stuff where they're like, it's sinfully delectable. Right? What do they mean? It's so good that it should be wrong, you know? Like, and God should say it's wrong because God's against pleasure and He's against fun, and so it's sinful, right? That's what people tend to mean when they use the word sin. So we as Christians have gotten away from the word sin, and we've instituted other words to try to explain to people why the world is so rotten. So instead of looking at an alcoholic and say he's sinning, I'll instead say he's an alcoholic. And we've become so crazy with this that everything's an addiction nowadays, isn't it? Someone's viewing porn, porn addict. Somebody shops too much, shopaholic. Somebody goes on their Instagram too much, Instagramaholic, you know, like Facebookaholic, right? Addicted to social media. You know, that's the words that we throw around. And it's, whether you realize it or not, incredibly damaging. It's incredibly damaging to use language like that. This is why. When I use the word addiction, it has a very different impact and meaning than sin. All addiction is sin, but not all sin is addiction. When I'm looking at somebody who uses meth, and I say that person's addicted, what I mean is that he has a biological dependency on a drug that's so severe that if he stopped using, you know what would happen to a meth addict if they just quit cold turkey? They would die. That's what I mean. So to look at somebody in the church and say, you're a porn addict, you see what that does to them? You see, let me put this in a perspective for you guys. If I told you guys I'm a meth addict, and then I confess to you guys this week, I'm like, hey, Ian, I just used meth today. How severely would you take that? I'd hope you'd take it pretty severely, right? I use meth today. I'm on meth right now, right? That's a severe thing to say because that is going to kill me, right? But then if I come to you and I say, hey, I'm a porn addict, and I viewed porn today, should you deal with it with the same level of severity? You probably shouldn't. But because we've mixed terms, you will. And in Christian lives, this is the problem that we're getting into. There is a vast difference between someone who is bulimic and anorexic versus someone who just struggles with their body image. You guys get that? There's a big difference, but in the church there isn't. She's anorexic. Why? Because she skipped a couple meals and she like cares about her body image? That's not anorexic. That's not an eating disorder. That's sin. That's vanity. There's a difference. You see, when you mix words, you muddle the issue and you make people feel unnecessarily wrong about themselves. You guys understand that? It's very important that we as a church understand what sin is so that we don't do that to people. So we don't label people things that they aren't. Okay? I just wanted you guys to think about that. So what is sin? Paul defines it in Romans 7, verse 15 through 19. He defines what sin is. But before we get to Paul, I'm going to give you guys a couple quotes from some big thinkers in Christianity to help you understand what he's saying. Dorothy Sayers, this is what she, how she defines sin. She said, sin is a deep interior dislocation of the soul. How many of you guys have ever had a bone pulled out of socket? I have. Most of you guys know, because it happened in this room. At any rate, thanks to an unnamed man who will remain unnamed, but he's not here and his name's Aaron. But anyway, when your bone goes out of socket, it's very different than your bone breaking. And this is what happens when your bone goes out of socket. It's incredibly painful because what happens is it goes out of socket and it lines on the bone elsewhere and it rubs on it and it hurts. What she's saying is that's what's happened to our souls. There is something dislocated in our souls, something completely out of place, out of socket. And those of you guys who have had a bone out of socket know that when a bone goes out of socket, it's useless until you put it back in. It's not like your shoulder's going to go out of socket and you're going to go play some tag football. You know, you're done. That shoulder's done. You're not going to use it. That's what she's saying is wrong with our very inner soul. It's dislocated. Charles Spufford, the guy who I just quoted, he put it this way. He said, you are a being whose wants make no sense. They don't harmonize. Whose desires deep down are discordantly arranged so that you truly want to possess and truly don't want to at the very same time. You're equipped, you realize, for farce or even tragedy far more than you are for happy endings. This is how he's defining sin. Sin is something that is so off-centered in your heart that you can want something and not want it at the very same time. And in everyday life, you guys are recognizing the effects of this, I hope. Right? You're thinking about what to eat for lunch. And you know that sucking down a ho-ho ain't the answer. But you want it. And you don't want it at the same time. You're in a relationship with someone, and it's going great. But there's a part of you that wants out. But you don't want out at the same time. And so you start doing passive-aggressive weird things, and you might even tank or self-destruct your own relationship. Right? You're in a job, and it's paying you well. And you should be happy with it. But instead, you can't shake this feeling that your life has no meaning, and you want to do something more important. And so you quit your well-paying job that would have done great things for you in order to be unemployed and living at your parents' house for the rest of your life, all because you felt a little bit unhappy. It might have more extreme examples. You might have a drug addiction. You might actually have an addiction in your life. You might actually have a disorder like the things that I was talking about. You might have more extreme examples. But the point remains that there, if you really examined your own heart, you would realize my desires make no sense. Some of the things that I've desired most powerfully have done most damage to my heart. Why do I want things that are ultimately bad for me? What's wrong with me? Martin Luther put it this way. He called it an inward curve. That's how he called it, what sin is. And he says, sin is a nausea towards doing good and a delicate delight in doing evil. That's how he called it. That your desires are so weird that when you do something wrong, you get happy about it. That when someone says, don't do this, when you do it, you feel good. And when someone says, you should do this, and you do it, you kind of feel lame about it. I'm such a rule follower. I suck. You know, like, you feel kind of lame about it. But when you're doing something wrong, you feel excited. You feel alive, right? That's what he's saying. There's something wrong with you. You're curved in on yourself. You're aimed at your own destruction, is what he's saying. And he's also referencing pride. He's saying that you're so curved in on yourself that even the good deeds that you do are ultimately curved in on your own benefit. Meaning, why do people do good deeds in our society? Why do people obey the speed limit? Is it because they're like, man, you know what? Because it's the right thing to do. Okay, I care about justice and safety, okay? That's why I follow the speed limit. Why do people follow the speed limit? You don't want to take it. You see how that's curved in on yourself? Who are you thinking about? You. So even in all the good things that you do, you're still obsessed with yourself. Martin Luther was famously quoted as saying to one of his higher-ups, who was getting sick of him confessing to him for 6 hours a day. And he's like, Martin, you got to stop this, bro. It's like you call every fart a sin. And Martin Luther very intelligently said to him, he's like, you don't understand. He says, before I was a Christian, I drank and I gambled and I hurt people for pleasure. And it was my pride and my selfishness that led me to live that kind of lifestyle. But now I'm a Christian and I'm a monk. And I do all these good things, but I do them for the wrong reasons. I give tithes and offerings so that I could be seen by other people and so I could feel good about myself to alleviate my guilty conscience over all the wrong deeds that I've done. I've dedicated my life to celibacy, but now I realize I've done that so that other people would look at me and say, what a great guy he is. I teach Bible studies, but now I realize that it's just because I have a deep passion to be liked by others. See what his point is? I can't even do good things for the right reason. There's something wrong with me. There's something dislocated in my soul. I don't know what it is. And he called that sin. So let me read the quote from Paul. Just give you, now that you guys have that background, so you see what he's saying. This is Romans 7, verse 15 through 19. I have it there. Paul says this, I don't really understand myself, for I want to do what is right, but I don't do it. Instead, I do what I hate. But if I know that what I am doing is wrong, this shows that I agree that the law is good. So I'm not the one doing the wrong. It is, get this, sin living in me that does it. And I know that nothing good lives in me, that is in my sinful nature. I want to do what is right, but I can't do it. I want to do what is good, but I don't. I don't want to do what is wrong, but I do it anyway. And then later on in verse 24, he says, oh, what a miserable person I am. Who will free me from this life that is dominated by sin and death? See what the definition of sin is for Paul? He's saying, I want to do right things. I know it's good for me to read my Bible. I know it's good for me to pray. I know it's good for me to go to church. I know it's good for me not to care so deeply what other people think about me. And not to eat this garbage and not to look at these things. I know that, but I don't do it. I know I'm not supposed to click on these things on the internet, but I do it anyway. I know I shouldn't say that to my wife, but I say it anyway. And he's saying, what's wrong with me? And he calls that sin. He calls it sin. So looking at all those, I'm going to give you my definition for sin. And this is the definition that we're going to be working off of for the next couple months. Sin is, to use a metaphor, sin is like a tree that is rooted deep inside of your heart. It's like a tree that's rooted deep inside of your heart. And the problem that we have as Christians, as believers, is we don't understand how deep those roots go. We just don't get it. We don't know. And let me explain it to you guys this way. So when you look at these trees, right? The reason why I'm using this as a metaphor, because I think it's the easiest way to understand what the Bible is saying. And what the Bible says is that there's this tree, and we're going to call this one sin. Okay? This is called sin. And the Bible says there's a source. There is something that gave this tree life. The Bible calls this faithlessness. The source for all sin in the universe, the source for all sin in the human heart, is the fact that we do not trust God. We'll get way into this next week, but let me give you a brief rundown. God created the human species not just to know Him, not just to obey Him, but to love Him. And trust is foundational for every relationship. You cannot truly love someone. You cannot truly respect them. You cannot truly have a relationship with them if you don't trust them. And this is what's wrong with our heart. We don't trust God. And you might be thinking, I trust God. Here's the proof. When God gives you a commandment, are you happy about it or are you a little bit upset? When God tells you you should wait till marriage to have sex, are you like, yes, God knows what's best for me. I trust Him. Or do you say, why? Why can't I do that? Why can't I lie? Why can't I commit adultery? Why can't I cheat? Why can't I steal? Why is God so unbelievably unfair? Why create all these pleasures and not let me partake in them? If you want to know where you're at with this, next time you sin, do you believe that God, when He tells you, I love you, that He means it? Or do you believe that He's actually really, really mad at you and doesn't forgive you and doesn't care about you and would rather have you die? That's all trust. That's what it is. We don't trust God. And because we don't trust God, we have lost a relationship with Him. It's given rise to this tree, to this deep ingrained sin that separates us from God. And because we're separated from God, our path leads to hell. It leads to damnation. So what else about this tree? Well, this tree has roots, and the root of sin is this funny word that we call pride. That's the root of sin. Pride is a focus on self, and that could be a negative focus on self or a positive focus on self. And this is what I mean. Some proud people are the obvious proud people. They just think they're better than everyone else, and they just talk about themselves all the time, and they only look out for their own self-interests. That's the obvious amount of pride. But there's another level of pride that most of us don't recognize as pride, but it is. It's the level of pride that thinks negatively on yourself all the time. I'm a failure. I'm a loser. Who could love me? I'm no good. Blah, 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 blah. Who are you thinking about? You. That's pride. That's what it is. Any focus on self, whether it is negative or positive, has its roots in pride. And that is why pride is the root for this whole thing. Now, this tree also has branches and bark and all these things. And what I'm going to call that is I'm going to call this envy. Envy, you call it lust, you could call it covetousness, whatever you want to call it. What envy refers to is it refers to a dissatisfaction that leads to a craving for more. Okay? That's what it is. And as I explain these other sins, envy will come into light. Okay? After envy, that's where you get into all the fruit of sin. And these are the ones that we recognize. Sexual lust, greed, adultery, wrath, vanity. All these stem from pride and envy. Let's take one of those. Vanity. Vanity. What is vanity and how does envy feed it? Vanity is an obsession with adoration from other people. That's what vanity is. Where does it come from? It comes from a dissatisfaction in who you are that you make up for through your looks, through your personality, through your talents, through your Instagram page, through your Facebook, through your YouTube channel, through your... You see where I'm going with this? And what it is it stems from this deep insecurity that you desperately want to be liked. It's a bottomless pit. It's a deep craving that comes from an emptiness and disappointment with your life. How about sexual lust? Sexual lust is built on entitlement, feeling that you have the right over other people's bodies to feel good, that you use and you fantasize about other people, either in your mind or physically, so that you can feel happy about yourself. Because you have this deep craving, this deep envy that comes out of your disappointment that you want more and more and more. And envy is never satisfied. Never satisfied. Now, you see the problem here? Most Christians are busy working on this. They're working on the fruit. They're like, we need to get rid of porn, and we need to get rid of lying, and we need to get rid of alcohol and cocaine and meth, and then we'll be good. What happens to a tree if you pluck all the fruit off? It just grows back. Or maybe you'll be successful and you get all this fruit off, but you know what you haven't dealt with? The root. That's why you have, in the Bible, the rich young ruler comes to Jesus. He's dealt with all the fruit. He comes to Jesus and he says, what do I need to do to be saved? And Jesus says, keep the commandments, right? Don't lie, don't murder, don't commit adultery. And you know what he says to Jesus? I've done that. I don't have any of the fruit of sin anymore. What do I still lack? What's wrong with me? And Jesus says, sell all you got. Give it to the poor. You're going to have treasure in heaven. Come follow me. And it says he walked away depressed because he had great things. That envy was never dealt with in his life. That pride was never dealt with in his life. That faithlessness towards God. Because what was Jesus saying? Leave your money because you'll have treasure where? In heaven. Trust me. I have better pleasure for you. See, his faithlessness and his pride and his envy were never dealt with. You could be the most righteous person on the outside, but if you haven't dealt with these internal things, you haven't dealt with sin. You haven't dealt with the problem. You haven't dealt with the issue that's really in you. And what God is doing is he's saying, it's not enough to just cut this tree down. He's going to do it, right? He's going to get at the roots of this thing, and he's going to work on you, and he's going to work on me to fix this. But ultimately, what he's actually doing is he's building this new tree. And we can call this tree salvation. And salvation, the source of salvation, I hope you guys know this. This is not trivia, but I hope you guys know this. The source of salvation is faith. If the source of sin is faithlessness, the source of salvation must be faith, right? If the root of sin is pride, then the root of salvation must be what? What? No. Humility is a really good guess. Humility, people say, is the opposite of pride. But actually, the definition of humility is just not focusing on yourself. So humility isn't the opposite of pride. Humility is just the absence of pride. Humility is one of the fruits that comes out of here. The root is actually... See, if the root of sin is focus on self, the root of salvation must be a focus on who? Jesus. We call that love. You love God. You love your neighbor as yourself. And that gets your eyes off of who? You. You're never going to beat pride by trying to stop being proud. You got to give your mind, you got to give your heart another affection. You got to go somewhere else, somewhere better. If envy is the branches from which all this comes from, what must be this on the tree of salvation? If you guys know Galatians 5, you'll know it. The fruit of the Spirit is love. Then what comes after that? Joy. Joy. If the source of all of my problems up here is the fact that I'm discontented in my life, the solution must be joy. Joy, a pleasure, a contentment, a peace in what God is doing in my life. That stems from my deep, abiding faith and love in Him. That cannot be taken away no matter what my life circumstances are. And what are the other fruits? Patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. That's what the tree of salvation brings into our lives. But you have to understand where the root is. It will do you no good to try to produce the fruit of the Spirit in your own power. You're not going to get anywhere. You can manufacture things that look a lot like it, but their root will always be pride and envy. You're going to look at Jesus and you're going to say, I'm doing all the right things, but I still have a lack. I'm still empty. I still feel just as empty as I was when I was in my sins. What do I do? See, you don't need new systems. You need a new tree. You need something different to grow in your life. And that's what God is doing in us. Now, in our culture, we don't want to offend. We don't want to call people sinners. And we don't want to offend ourselves, especially. I want to call myself a sinner. But Paul takes the first three chapters of this book to argue how desolate we are without God's help. How much of sinners we really are. He spends the first three chapters just trying to cut everybody down. And you're like, why would Paul do that? This is why. Sin is a terminal disease. It's a cancer in your life. It will kill you and everyone else around you. But the beauty of the gospel is that it is a cured illness. It's a cured illness. And here's the truth. There's only one way a cured illness can kill you, and that is if you deny it exists, or if you don't have the means to get the cure, right? Those are the only ways that you can die of a cured illness. If you deny it exists, or you don't have the means to get the cure, sin denies its own existence because it's rooted in pride. Pride does not want to admit that you're a sinner. But if you don't admit it, you can't be saved. This is John 8, verse 31 through 36. Then Jesus said to the Jews who believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son does. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." What were these people's problem? They denied the existence of sin inside their life, and so because of that, they could have no part of Jesus. They could not have salvation. The beauty of the gospel is that God sent His Son to bear our sins, to become sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God, so that this new tree of life and salvation can grow beautifully inside of your life and save you. Save you from all the things that are bringing you down, all the anxiety and fears and broken relationships and problems in your life that are extending out. That God says, "I could save you, but you got to admit that you need it. You got to see that there's a problem." And the beauty is that if you're saved tonight, you've already begun. He's already begun this work in you. But the better you understand your sin, the more you can cry out for God's help. And the more you cry out for His help, the more you partake of this salvation that He offers us. There are some Christians who they're going to make it to heaven, but their lives are going to be wasted on sin. It says in 1 Corinthians 3 that there will be some who will make it to heaven as through the fire. That they're going to burn in their lust and their pride and their envy all their life, and they will have nothing but regret at the end. But there will be some who, because they had the humility to admit it and because they sought the help that they needed, will have lives of glorious fruition. The most gracious thing that God could do for any one of us is to call us sinner. Because when He calls us sinner, He is offering you to become a son. And that's what we should want. That's what we should want in our lives, for us and for everyone else. That is what's going to save this world. Right? It's not programs. It's not new political systems. It's Jesus. Let's pray. Dear God, thank You. Thank You for this message of Your Son, that You did come and You did suffer and You did die on our behalves. We're so very thankful for You. Please, God, help us. God, break us of our pride. Show us in humility what is wrong with our hearts, God, that we might cry out for Your salvation, that we might taste it and we might see that it is sweeter than anything we found on this earth, that it's worth being broken if You can mend us. We love You, Lord, and we thank You. And in Your name, amen.